graph limit subject, so the limit objects will be called graphings, but other than that it's true. And so this is a joint work with Agnes Backhaus. She is a very active member of my research group on limits of discrete structures, which is, by the way, supported generously by the European Union. And the talk is based on two recent papers. The first one is already on the archive and submitted. The second one, we are just finishing the paper and we put it on the archive soon. And these papers fit into a longer research project in the frame of which we study random deregular graphs using graph limit techniques. So let me say a few words on random regular graphs. So let G and D denote the random deregular graph on n vertices introduced in the talk of Nick Wormald. And typically we will think of D as a fixed number and n a large number. So we want to understand the asymptotic properties of random deregular graphs. If you take such a graph, then it looks like a tree locally. This was also in the talk of Nick. If you look at a random point and you look around, you typically, very high probability, you see just a tree, a regular tree. So locally they are not very interesting, but globally they seem to have a very mysterious and interesting global geometry that we try to understand. And in this talk I will make precise this notion of global geometry, what we mean by that. So one of the major results about random regular graphs is by Joel Friedman. This is saying that G is almost Ramanujan, namely the second largest eigenvalue in the absolute value is about twice square root of D minus 1. And so the original proof was 100 pages long, recently simplified by Shar Bordanev to 20 pages, which is a significant simplification. And so I am going to discuss spectral properties of random regular graphs. And let me just review some of the old and new theory of random matrices. These objects were first studied by Wigner, the physicist. And a Wigner matrix is just a random symmetric matrix. It IID entries. Typically, it's assumed that the entries have expectation zero, and various models are considered. So Wigner conjectured that the spacing between the line of the spectrum of a complicated quantum system, say a heavy atom, for example, is complicated enough, like a uranium atom, that should resemble the spacings between the eigenvalues of random matrix. Another beautiful connection of random matrices to some other subject is to the Riemann zeta function. It was conjectured that the zeros of the Riemann zeta function on the one half line have a similar distribution as the eigenvalues of a random matrix. So, by the way, random matrix theory is very active recently. So there are new results by, this is not Paul Erdős, this is László Erdős. As far as I know, they are unrelated. He's also Hungarian. Antti Nolasz, Terence Tao, Van Wu, Yao Yin, and so many others. So this is not a complete list, of course. So this is a dynamically developing subject with beautiful and very complicated results. So two major questions you can ask about random matrices is one question about the eigenvalue distribution, how they look from a large distance. This is the spectral measure, which is well known, by the way. And the other is when you put it under the microscope and you enlarge it and you look at the eigenvalue, the spaces between the eigenvalues, So this is the local investigation of eigenvalues. And then, of course, another but closely related subject is the structure of eigenvectors. How do they look like? You take the eigenvector of a random matrix. What can we say about that? So now let's go back to random regular graphs, and we can view them as random matrices as well. We can think of G and D as just a random symmetric 0-1 matrix in which now we condition the row sums and the column sums to be D. And now it is very interesting to compare spectral properties of Wigner matrices and random D regular graphs. How similar are they? Let me start with the most classical fact, the semicircle law, an old fact, which says that spectral measure, if you take the eigenvalues of a random matrix and you put a uniform distribution on these eigenvalues, then this law says that this is, in the weak topology, it approximates the so-called semicircle measure coming from the semicircle. There is a similar statement for random D regular graphs, which is actually not hard to prove. This is the fact that if you look at a similar spectral measure for a random D regular graph, then this will be very close. It will approximate the so-called Kesten-McKay measure, which depends on D, by the way. And as D goes to infinity, this is more and more like this semicircle distribution. So it's an approximate semicircle law. By the way, this fact does not really use that G is random. It only uses that it's an essentially large Gertz graph, that it has very few short cycles. So it shows that this is not really a deep fact about random D regular graphs. It's more like just about large Gertz graphs. Now, the eigenvalue spacing for random D regular graphs, as far as I know, I actually told recently to experts, it's extremely difficult and it's unknown. So probably we have to wait a lot for that. So the main conjecture about the eigenvectors, which is, by the way, closely related to the eigenvalue spacing, experts see some kind of deep connection between the two questions, is that if you take any eigenvector and then you normalize it such that the L2 norm is square root of n, then the entry distribution, namely you take a random entry from this vector, a uniformly chosen random entry, then the distribution is close to the standard normal distribution, n0, 1, in the weak topology. So the normalization, the square root n normalization, is something entirely trivial that we have to normalize it like that. The motivation for that is that if you would normalize it to have lengths equal to 1, then the entries would be just minuscule. You wouldn't see that. So this is exactly the normalization with which, if you take a random entry, then that random variable will have variance 1, right? So that's the motivation. So you want to normalize this entry distribution in a way that it has variance 1, and that's it.
Balazs, do you mean to conjecture that for every eigenvector V?
Every eigenvector. You have a large random D-regular graph, and then every eigenvector should be close to this. Yeah, that's very important. Thank you. And despite of significant effort, very little was known about this entry distribution.
For the largest one, right?
Sorry?
That's not true for the largest one.
Oh, I mean, if D goes to infinity with N, then there are results about that. Sorry?
The largest eigenvector is just
constant. Oh, the largest, I ignored, like the constant.
Yeah, just ignore that. Okay.
That's not an eigenvector. Just joking. Actually, by the way, if you take the largest eigenvector and then you normalize it to have expectation 0, then this is some Gaussian distribution. That has some relevance to it. But a trivial Gaussian distribution with variance 0. So the most interesting results which are known are due to Brooks and Lindell-Strauss. So this is some weak, this is a mistake on the slide, delocalization result, saying that they cannot, the values cannot be supported on very few vertices, I mean this probability distribution. It cannot happen that, so here is the vector, here is the entries of the vector, it has n entries, and then the, it cannot happen that somehow the L2 weight is concentrated on a very, very little fraction of vertices. Unfortunately, it cannot exclude that it concentrated on a small fraction. It just excludes some very little fraction. So it's some kind of a delocalization result. And I also have to mention a recent, also beautiful result which goes in the direction of quantum unique ergodicity, also a very fashionable topic motivated by Riemann surfaces, and this is Nalini Anantharaman. Beautiful results, but unfortunately they don't really give any information on this value distribution. It's somewhat related. So a corollary of our main theorem is that we almost answered this question for the value distribution, for the entry distribution. What we prove, actually this is not the main theorem we prove. In some sense we prove a stronger statement. So in another sense we prove a stronger statement than the conjecture, and in one sense we prove a weaker statement. So we prove that if you take an eigenvector and then you normalize it to have length equal to square root of n, then the entry distribution is close to some Gaussian distribution with sigma between 0 and 1. There is a mistake there. It's a 1 in the weak topology. Unfortunately, we cannot even exclude sigma equals to 0. What would that mean, that sigma equals to 0? That's a trivial distribution concentrated on 0. So that means that with this normalization, you could see just 0 almost everywhere. That would mean that the eigenvector is heavily localized. Most of the L2 weight is just concentrated on a few vertices. Again, the same phenomenon on which the Brooks-Lindenstrauss theorem says something weak. But so this theorem that we prove does not exclude the case that you just have an eigenvector, and if you sample random entries for it, typically you just see zero. Question?
What is the value of D in this theorem?
Sorry?
D?
The
degree.
I mean, it's a fixed degree and n is large.
A fixed degree.
Fixed degree. We always fix D forever. It's 3.
Even if sigma was 0.9, it would be very similar. I mean, it would be something very strange, right? If sigma was 0.9, you wouldn't be getting the square root of n from the small values.
So, for example, if sigma exists to 0.1, that... that would mean that some of the values, some of the L2 weight of the eigenvector is
right.
Concentrated on a small fraction, and the rest is Gaussian.
Yeah.
So it is basically, this is some kind of a structure theorem. You can view it as a structure theorem that every eigenvector is composed of a heavily localized part and the delocalized part, which is Gaussian. The delocalized part has to be Gaussian. So this is the statement. But actually, a result is stronger in two ways than the original conjecture. It holds for almost eigenvectors as well. So vectors now, if you normalize them to have one length one, then almost eigenvector just means that this eigenvector equation is satisfied approximatively. And if you take any almost eigenvector, then this has the same property. This is far more general than eigenvectors. There are almost eigenvectors which are not close to any eigenvector. In fact, if you take two lambdas that are close to each other, and two eigenvectors with these lambda 1 and lambda 2 eigenvalues, and you take any linear combination of them, that's again an almost eigenvector. If the two lambdas are close enough. So this is a far more general statement, and so this is the first way in which this is more general, the actual main theorem. And also, our statement says something much more than the original value distribution conjecture. This is also saying that you can look at you can use the geometry of graph, of the graph, of the underlying graph to sample many values simultaneously. So you can, for example, pick a random point in the graph, you can look at a neighborhood of radius 1, and you can look at the value, the Of course, the eigenvector can be just looked at as a labeling of the vertices of the graph with numbers. And then you look around in the neighborhood of radius 1 of a randomly chosen point, and then you look at the values. Like here you see, for example, 0.1 minus 1 and blah, blah. And then you can look at how they are distributed jointly in small neighborhoods. And we also prove that for almost eigenvectors, this joint distribution is jointly Gaussian. So it's far more general than just the entry distribution. This has a very big importance in the proof, in the structure of the proof. Sorry?
Just independent?
No, not independent. I will come back to that. There is a unique covariance structure depending on lambda. There is a beautiful theory behind it, which is related to the spherical representation of the automorphism group of the tree. So now, a nice fact is that our result is best possible for almost eigenvectors. Sigma can be anything for almost. There are examples for almost eigenvectors that are completely delocalized. There are examples for almost eigenvectors that are completely localized, and there is everything in between them. So this is best possible, the result for almost eigenvectors. And
what's an almost eigenvector?
Almost eigenvector is just a vector which satisfies this eigenvector approximation just approximately, with a small error. So now, some motivation to why we study this problem, which is of course interesting on its own right, and the spectral properties are always interesting. They are related to the global geometry of the graph. There are beautiful results about representing the geometry of a graph by taking dominant eigenvectors and then using them to map the vertices into a low-dimensional space. So they are somehow explore these eigenvectors, explore the geometry of the graph in a non-trivial way. And so that's one motivation, but there is another motivation. So this problem, actually, I want to convince you that this problem belongs to a similar class of problem as, for example, the maximal independent set, maximal cuts, and so on, exactly the problem that were considered in the talk of Nick Wormald. So this belongs to the same class of problems. So what connects them is that in all of these problems, we try to construct a labeling of the vertices of G satisfying some local rule. Why is that? For example, if you want to study an independent set, then you want to label the vertices of the graph by zeros and ones. And of course, the local rule is that two ones cannot be neighbors. Like, this cannot happen. So this is some kind of a labeling. And then with this restriction, you want to find some, like, what is the densest possible set of ones you can put on the graph. So basically, but a richer problem to study than just the maximal independent set is just describe all possible local statistics of independent sets, right? So this is something to understand. And these eigenvectors, almost eigenvectors, just fall into the same category of problems. You want to label the vertices with numbers such that they satisfy the eigenvector equation at every point. So the local rule is just saying that if you take the sum of these labels, so this is like x0, x1, x2, x3, then at every point of the graph I have to say that x0 times lambda is equal to x1 plus x2 plus x3, right? So these are just local rules, and then I want to understand labelings of the random deregular graph with this property. So we can hope that if we solve any of these problems falling into this general class, then this teaches us something, some general method. So this is how mathematics is being developed. We solve special things, and then we hope that it gives some bigger picture. For example, the problems in Nick's formal talks led to the differential equation method, which is a more general method, and so this is a beautiful example how the theory is being developed. And in our case, we develop a so-called graph limit, or you can equivalently say it's an ergodic theoretic approach, which we believe that this method will find many other applications in random regular graphs. So I consider this result as a part of a bigger picture, and that's very interesting. this bigger picture. So let me actually go to the main topic, which is the some background theory for the proof. The proof is rather complicated, and it uses a limit approach. We go to the limit with the whole situation, and we study random deregular graphs in the limit. But how do we go to the limit? So let D be a fixed number. Is there some nice and interesting infinite structure which is the limit object of random deregular graphs on a growing number of vertices? Some Platonic object which expresses many of the properties of random deregular graphs. And there is a limit concept called Benjamin-Isham limit. But unfortunately, random deregular graph, I mean, fortunately, they converge in the Benjamin-Isham limit, but unfortunately, this convergence does not give too much information on random deregular graphs. They converge to the infinite deregular tree. If you know what Benjamin-Isham, so how many of you know what Benjamin-Isham limit is? You make me happy. Okay, that's very good. So in this limit concept, this is true, but it's somewhat boring because this does not distinguish random deregular graphs for any other Lie-Gerz graphs. They also converge to the infinite tree, so this doesn't give us extra information on them. There is something which is called the local global convergence. We developed the theory of that with Hatami and Lovas together, and so we say that two graphs, G and H, are similar. If they are similar in the Benjamin-Isham metric first, so this is already a requirement, it will be a refinement of the Benjamin-Isham metric. And if you put any extra structure, some labeling on one of the graphs, say a coloring with zeros and one, you can always model that on the other graph with a coloring such that the two colorings have similar local statistics. If you sample little balls of bounded radius, then what you see is similar. So this means that whatever global structure you can detect on one graph in this sense, this can be reproduced on the other graphs and vice versa. This is some kind of, this leads to a similarity notion. I don't want to go to the precise definition because it has boring details, but I hope you get the hang of it. So if G and H are close in this metric, and G is close to some if G is close to be bipartite, then so is H, because being bipartite can be expressed by a labeling and local statistics. Namely, you can put if G is close to be bipartite, then you can label the vertices with ones and zeros such that ones are not connected to each other and zeros are. So on every edge you see a one and a zero at the two endpoints. So this is a property which can be expressed by a labeling, and many other properties can be. Also, for example, if two graphs are close in this topology, they have to have the same independence ratio and blah blah. So many things are similar. So here is a conjecture which we believe. Is it true that a growing sequence of random deregular graphs is local global convergent with probability 1, or at least stochastically? So we don't know. We believe it. And actually, this is a general conjecture saying that everything which is similar to the independence ratio will converge. This was also in Nick's talk, that Bajati, Gamarnyik, and Tetali, for example, prove that the independence ratio converges. But this is just one aspect of this convergence. So we conjecture that everything converges, which falls into this category. It's not hard to prove, but it's extremely useful, that from every growing sequence of natural numbers, you can choose a subsequence such that the above statement becomes true. So now, in that subsequence of integers, if you take a growing sequence of random deregular graphs with that many vertices, it will converge with probability 1. And the proof relies on a very classical concentration result, which is even discussed in the famous Erdős-Spencer book of random method. So the heart of the proof of this is just that random deregular graphs, if you fix n vertices, then they are highly concentrated in this metric. And this is really the method. We don't claim the method. This is a classical method. You can go through that. It's this Azuma inequality, martingale, whatever concentration things are involved. And yeah. So local global convergence is that if you have two graphs, so first of all, they have to be similar in the Benjamin-Isham metric. Secondly, if you color the vertices of one of the graphs with ones and zeros, say, so two colors.
When you say that, you mean only with ones and zeros, or any finite colors, or?
Good question. So the it's built into the metric is that with the more color you can use, the more similar they are. Bounded number of colors. I mean, there is. I mean,
so.
Sorry. So the thing is that the closer they are, the more colors you can use. But okay. So let's say with two colors. If you color the first graph with two colors, then you can also color. In any way, so this is important that for every coloring, you can find another coloring of the other graph with two colors, such that if you look at the local statistics, the distribution of color neighborhoods of radius 10, say, then it is similar as the distribution here. So you can model whatever structure you put on one graph using an extra labeling, you can model it on the other graph. It explores the global properties of the graph. So in such colorings, you can encode largest independent set and such things.
Well, where do these small cycles fit into this?
You don't see the small... Sorry?
I mean, yeah, but you might have a random deregular graph.
The good thing is that... that has very small probability.
Asymptotics.
Asymptotics, yeah. Right, so this has very small probability.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, other question?
What is the limit of the subsequent?
Sorry?
In the theorem, in the previous slide, you said that a subsequence of the graph is not convergent.
There is a subsequence of the integer such that if you choose random deregular graphs, this. And the limit object, what is the limit? I mean, we don't quite know, that's the problem. We know that there is some limit object, and the limit objects can be always represented. We proved that with Lotzi and Hamed. They can always be represented as certain measurable infinite graphs called graphings. And it is an interesting question to even just to state a conjecture what this infinite object is, which is the Platonic idealistic random deregular graph. We would like to know that. What is that? Now, how does ergodic theory come into the picture? I draw a little... So this will be the, I apologize in advance, this is a bit abstract. I don't know. How many of you know Furstenberg-type classical ergodic theory? Okay, that makes me less happy, but... So it's just an interpretation. So this is a beautiful theory, and one interpretation of Furstenberg's beautiful approach to additive combinatorics is that let's take probability measures on this compact set 0, 1 to the z, which are invariant under the natural shift on the coordinates. More generally, if G is a group and it acts on some set omega, In the above case, for example, Z acts on itself, then we can study G invariant Borel measures on if C is a compact set, C to the omega is a compact set, and obviously G acts on that compact set, and we can then study G invariant Borel probability measures on this compact space. So for us, the interesting case is when omega is just the deregular tree and G is the automorphism group of the tree. So, actually, so this drawing is just to here to explain these concepts. So, you can equivalently think of this Furstenberg language. You are probably, so maybe this is more familiar for you. Imagine that you have a sequence of random variables, infinitely many, labeled by the integers, okay? So this is an infinite dimensional joint distribution. And then imagine that you want to understand those joint distributions which are invariant under the natural shift of these random variables. It's some group invariance property which restricts the possible joint distributions greatly. So, and it turns out that you can equivalently, like if you have this situation, this can be equivalently modeled in a way that you just have a general measure space, and then T acts on it. There is a measure-preserving transformation, invertible measure-preserving transformation. You just have one variable, which we call x0, and then we can transform this x0 into many other random variables by applying T, and then you get such a system. This is an equivalent way of stating the same thing. So you actually, the study of measure-preserving systems and such invariant joint distributions is equivalent. And you can do the same thing for the tree. So assume you have the infinite regular tree, and then you put random variables on the vertices, and we impose the invariance property that this joint distribution has to be invariant under the automorphism group of the tree. So this is the language that we are going to use. So now the good news is that if GI is a large Gersh sequence of D-regular graphs, and you have some sequence of colorings, which are these colored D-regular graphs, are convergent in the Benjamin-Isham metric, meaning that these local colored colored statistics converge, then
once again, about getting clear about this, what the convergence means. Do you mean that for any number, if you replace 0, 1 by any number k, that then it's converging?
Now we left the local global convergence for a while. In fact, here I'm giving an equivalent language to that. That was the motivation, but now I'm translating that into ergodic theory. So now we left that metric, and we just simply say that if you have a large Gersh sequence of D-regular graphs, so the Gersh is tending to infinity, essential Gersh, and then you put colorings in a way that these colorings converge in the Benjamin-Isham sense, that local statistics will converge, then the limit object is nothing but such an object, an invariant set, a group invariant set of random variables. And so this is a nice thing. This resembles to Furstenberg's correspondence principle. So now here comes our main definition. We call a process on TD typical if it comes from colorings of random D-regular graphs. So this is a special class of such joint distributions. Now, what is the more precise definition? So, I mean, mu there is just a joint distribution. If we say that is typical if there is a sequence of natural numbers such that with probability, with the property that if you choose a random, the sequence of random D-regular graphs with that many vertices, like Ni, then with probability 1, they have a coloring such that it converges to this particular coloring. So that just means that this limiting process can be reproduced from random D-regular graphs as a limit coloring. And So, I already explained that, and it turns out that this is a beautiful and interesting class of invariant processes on the tree, which this class somehow is related to the properties of random D-regular graphs. So instead of studying random D-regular graphs, we study this type of typical processes. Now, a remark is that this class of processes contains a well-known class of processes which are called factor of IID processes. It turns out that the two class of processes are not identical. This was proved by Gamarnyik and Sudan. So this is strictly smaller. Even if you take weak closure, the closure in the weak topology, they are not closed. You can take the closure. And even then, this is not the same as typical processes. So you get some interesting... So factor of IID processes, by the way, is an interesting thing. You first put entirely independent, random variables on the vertices, and then you use a local rule to transform it to another process. I don't go into the details of that, but that's a very interesting class either, and many people study that. So this is a slightly bigger class, and it's a mysterious class. We don't have any nice description for this class of typical processes. But here is the basic philosophy. We study the structure of random deregular graphs by just studying the properties of typical processes. All that you want to know is encoded in there. So, and the final goal, just give a useful characterization of typical processes, which leads to some kind of structure theorem for random deregular graphs. So, let me mention something that our main theorem is our main theorem is equivalent with a very nice fact about these typical processes. So there are certain processes on the tree, we call them eigenvector processes. So an eigenvector process is just a process where the values are from the real number, so this is a real valued process. And with probability 1, it has to satisfy the eigenvector equation at every point with eigenvalue lambda. So with probability 1, it has to satisfy that lambda times x0 is just the sum of the neighbors. So in this case, for example, it's like x1 plus x2 plus x3 in the three regular case. And that has to be satisfied at every point. So these are very special processes because with probability 1, somehow they describe a wave on the tree. And our main theorem is equivalent with the following theorem. If you have an eigenvector process which is typical, then it has to be a jointly Gaussian process, eigenvector process. And those are characterized in the literature. So there is a unique one, there is a unique Gaussian eigenvector process for each lambda. And so basically this is what we prove in the limiting language. So now we need some kind of facts about typical processes to start the proof. Somehow we have to start the proof. So what do we use about typical processes? We need some necessary conditions. And let me mention that with Agnes Backhaus and Balint Virág, we described possible correlation structures in typical processes using Friedman theorem. But this is not enough for our case. And then these two papers I mentioned study entropic information theoretic conditions, necessary conditions for typical processes. For example, instead of looking at the slides, let me draw a picture of what kind of inequalities I mean. And these inequalities actually are rooted in the work of Louis Bowen on the F invariant, which is on factor of IID processes. So if you have a typical process which takes its values in a finite set, then you can look at various finite subsets of the tree. Say, again, we look at x0, x1, x2, and x3. So now this is a finite valued process. And then you can look at the joint entropy. And then you can ask, you can formulate, it turns out you can formulate interesting necessary conditions for these entropies for typical processes. And there are the main one that we use is that if you take a star, so you take the entropy, actually this is not what we use a refinement of that. Unfortunately, this was not enough. But if you look at the entropy restricted on a star of a finite value typical process, and then this has to be bigger than d half times the entropy on an edge. You can look at just the entropy restricted to an edge, and this is the entropy of a star. So there are such entropic inequalities, which look very useful, but unfortunately they turned out to be not enough for us. So we had to prove something, a refinement of these entropic inequalities. So this is just a quick review on Gaussian eigenvector processes, the history. I will skip a lot from here. So as I said, there are certain special eigenvector processes which are jointly Gaussian, and for each lambda there is a unique one. These were first characterized by Jehonatan and Elon, and there is a paper with title Gaussian waves on the regular tree, and then this theory was further developed by Harangi and Virag. They proved that if lambda is in the Ramanujan interval, then the corresponding Gaussian wave is in the V closure of factor of IID processes. This is a fact that we use in the proof, by the way. By the way, a corollary of Harangi and Virag is already saying that every large Gers deregular graph has many completely delocalized approximative eigenvectors. So this is a way of constructing delocalized almost eigenvectors as well. Now let me say a little bit about some facts about the proof. As I said, the proof is very long and rather complicated, so I'm not able to really describe it, but I try to give you some sketch.
What are you proving now?
And the main theorem, but in the limiting form. So the statement now is that if you have an eigenvector process which is typical, then it's jointly Gaussian. And so the first difficulty is that entropy does not work for infinite probability distributions. I mean, especially in our case, the probability distributions are on R, and we have some inequality for finite-valued processes. But now we study processes which are R-valued. So this is a true difficulty, and it was very hard to get around this. It took us a half a year. So the solution, of course, what you can try is you can try to discretize these processes and then try to use the finite entropy inequalities. If you discretize a typical process, then it remains typical, so you get some conditions. But this does not really work because when you discretize, you have some very bad error terms which we could not control. So the solution was that we had to formulate a finer entropy inequality, which is even finer than that, and that was designed to swallow these uncontrollable error terms, and actually some magic cancellation of infinities happened. And after this discretization, you get a differential and an inequality for differential entropies for R-value typical processes. Now, there was some other technical thing that this differential entropy is various technical problems. I just mentioned a few. For example, if you look at an eigenvector process, you restrict it to a star, which is a D plus one dimensional distribution. It will concentrate it on a one-codimensional space. So the differential entropy of the whole thing is not defined, it's minus infinity. But actually we introduce the subspace differential entropies where we restrict the distribution. We just look at the differential entropy inside that subspace. And it turns out that that subspace differential entropy satisfies that inequality. We also had to smoothen somewhat the eigenvector process to actually have a finite differential entropy. This goes by some heating process. We use some tricks here. Unfortunately, this is not tight for the Gaussian, so again, we were very unhappy. It seemed to be useless. But then it turned out that you can have entropy inequalities of similar fashions using larger and larger balls on the tree, and then it becomes more and more tight, this inequality, that if you apply that for Gaussian. So again, we found another magic cancellation of infinities. So if you look at larger and larger balls here around the star and larger balls around the single edge, and then you look at this differential entropy and this differential entropy, both go to infinity radically, but if you take the difference of them for a Gaussian process, it goes to zero. Actually, when I made some computer experiments before I knew that, before we proved that, and I almost fell off my chair because it was so surprising, these two dramatically growing things. We knew that if the difference would go to zero, that would help, but actually the computer experiment showed that. It was like it is some kind of huge lack in the proof, I would say. We proved that later, that this fact is true for Gaussians. So that shows that it's kind of tight. The inequality is tight for Gaussians if you go to infinity with k, which is good news because it has a chance to prove that the Gaussianity. So now I'm just giving you feelings about the proof. This sequence of inequalities, we could go back to the case of just the star and the edge and prove that any typical eigenvector process has the same, like if you take this difference between like this differential entropy and this differential entropy, then that difference has to be at most as much as for the Gaussian distribution. Yeah, I know. And so, anyways, so these are a bit less interesting details. Let me jump to... you may ask the following question when you look at such a complicated proof, like, how do you get Gaussianity? You may get it from some central limit theorem, for example. You may, for example, originally we wanted to have asymptotically independent random variables and then establish those values as sums of those asymptotically independent variables. But we ended up with a proof which does not have anything to do with the central limit theorem. We get Gaussianity in a totally different way. And this is more along the lines of this famous fact that among random variables with a given variance, the Gaussian distribution maximizes differential entropy. So basically, the Gaussian distribution has this nice extremal property. And then, with long work, we could find a linear, like a linear expression of various differential entropies, which we knew that. Somehow, the typical eigenvector process so we got some inequalities for a typical eigenvector process in the form of a linear combination of differential entropies, and then we ended up with a problem that what kind of distribution maximizes a certain linear combination which has negative terms. The literature doesn't really say anything about that, so we had to develop a method which was basically, let me still tell you this one, this is a nice thing that I learned from this project. So the way how we handled that, it was the heat equation. We slowly heated up the situation. We composed more and more Gaussian into the picture. So we started with a general typical eigenvector process, and then we started to compose more and more Gaussian. It's like a heating process. It's like running a heat equation. And then we looked at how the differential entropy changes over time. I mean, this linear expression in the differential entropy, and the derivative of that turned out to be something which is called the Fisher information. There are beautiful things that we rediscovered, this so-called de Bruijn's inequality for Fisher information. And it turned out that somehow that controls the situation. So we ended up with an information theoretic differential equation at the end in a heat propagation situation. So this is how we got the Gaussianity. But these are just feelings. I just wanted to give you some idea of what kind of methods we used here. Quite interestingly, we also used some complex function theory. This is some other thing that I learned, that some beautiful fact that if you start with any probability distribution on R to the N, and then you run the heat equation, so you heat it up, meaning that you compose an independent Gaussian, then the density function of that resulting distribution, if you result it to any one-dimensional line, it will be it can be extended to an entire analytic function on the complex plane, which means that it becomes very nice, and that actually means it has some holographic property that from every tiny interval you can reproduce that whole distribution on the line. So this uses complex function theory, and we actually needed such things as well in the proof, and let me finish here. So We will put it on the archive, hopefully in 2 weeks. Thank you.
Questions?
Inequality plus symmetries. What was the symmetries?
Yes, so we had to eventually, at the end, we had to analyze a finite dimensional situation. We got some entropy inequality for this restricted distribution. It's actually on a star. We restricted the situation to a star. Eventually, we could do that. And we got some inequality there for the differential entropy of the process. But you also know that this is an invariant under the automorphism groups. So this is an extra information that this is this distribution that you have to analyze is symmetric under the symmetries of the star. So this we used also the symmetries of the situation to. So everything was just right. We just barely got it, but we used everything basically.
Yes.
We just use ergodic. We just use the language of ergodics here.
We just use the language.
No, we don't use anything from Furstenberg's work.
This kind of ergodic theoretical plus information theoretical approach, do you think what kind of other problems are suitable for this kind of approach?
Our final goal is to say something like this. A process is typical if and only if it satisfies these and maybe it's a bunch of entropy inequalities. And we want to characterize typical processes in terms of information theory. That would be a nice final goal.
Could you say a few words on the correlation structure of the Gaussian field?
Yes. Actually, this is a very beautiful thing because if you have a jointly Gaussian distribution, which is invariant under the automorphism group, then it's well known that you can represent that equivalently by a system of vectors in a Hilbert space, where the correlations are just the scalar products of these vectors. And every Gaussian invariant process, because of this, corresponds to a beautiful, very symmetric vector representation in a Hilbert space of the tree. Moreover, the automorphism group acts on this Hilbert space by in the natural way. So for that reason, you can understand the correlation structures in these Gaussian processes in the following way. Take a unitary representation of the automorphism of group of the tree. Take a vector which is invariant under the stabilizer of a point. And then, if you look at the orbit of that, that will naturally correspond to the vertices of the tree. And so these spherical representations, these are called spherical representations where there is a vector where the stabilizer is where the stabilizer of this fixes that vector. So there is a correspondence between spherical representations and these kind of Gaussian things. So there is a background theory here, but actually you can just sit down and calculate the covariance structure. It's a non-trivial thing, and it's related to many things, like non-backtracking random walks. So there is a bunch of beautiful mathematics here.
Any other questions? Then let's thank the speaker again and break it up.